The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
He's got the footwork down.
And those are some moves.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV shows here at SBS. And I'm joined by my co-host, SBS channel manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Fee. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. I have been watching quite a lot of television, so, you know, that's all the more reason to do a podcast about it.
That's what we're here for.
So this week on The Playlist, the horrors of 1950s America become all too real in the new HBO series Lovecraft Country. We pay tribute to the sad passing of Chadwick Boseman and catch up with what have you been watching.
Sounds like a full show. Let's do it.
Sophie, how much are you aware of the work of H.P. Lovecraft, which has inspired this new HBO series?
Well, in truth, more by reputation than by anything I've read or watched. I do understand he casts a wide influence in sci-fi and fantasy genre, but has a terrible reputation for horrendous racism. And listeners, long-time listeners might recall a conversation I had with Richard Stanley, director of Color Out of Space, about Lovecraft. And so how that film, which was a Lovecraft adaptation, dealt with race and his choice in casting an actor of color in the lead as his way to offset some of the issues around H.P. Lovecraft. But, yeah, that's a long-winded answer to your how much am I aware of him. What about you, Ben?
I'm not all that familiar. I mean, I know that Lovecraftian gets thrown around in the horror genre. I think sort of people like Guillermo del Toro is influenced. You know, I think that the influence is pretty pervasive. But, yeah, no, it's interesting that point you make about race, because I think that does lead us to this new series, which is based on a novel from a couple of years ago. And this series has been created by Misha Green, who previously had done a series called Underground about slavery. And it's taking the kind of horror world of H.P. Lovecraft, you know, these kind of monsters that live in particularly that New England part of the United States, and then in a way kind of crash landing this pre-civil rights African-American story from the 1950s into that world, which is, I guess, a pretty intense culture clash.
Bad for my own, scared for myself. Just because they don't want you here doesn't mean you're not supposed to be. Gotta get
away. This is an invitation to unmitigated power.
Where in the hell did I go wrong with you, boy? I told you to stay away from that damn place.
There's something here. Just trying to get out.
Everything is where and as it should be. From God to man.
And I have to say, I think it works really well. I really love the way it has figurative monsters becoming real in these vampire-like creatures that just pop up against real-life monsters for, you know, I'm talking Ku Klux Klan members, racist police officers in towns, racist people in towns that the travellers, the leads of our show, encounter along the way. And, you know, this is a carload of black people driving in Jim Crow South in the 50s. There is literal life and death danger facing them. And then this series throws in some mega monsters too. I'm actually really hooked. What about you?
I think this might be a show that we differ a little bit on. I mean, I kind of went into this with high expectations. I mean, it also sort of has the pedigree of Jordan Peele, and there is a sort of Get Out feel in at least the sort of first couple of episodes of sort of kind of entering this sort of very white world as these black characters who are outsiders and whether they are kind of really embraced or not, sort of when they get to this kind of, you know, mysterious sort of village in the woods that doesn't quite exist on the maps. But I just think the sort of the horror genre on television is a kind of interesting one. And this is a series that, you know, sort of relishes in kind of throwing these monsters on screen, at least in the first couple of episodes. And to be honest, I found them a bit hokey, which kind of broke the spell a bit for me. In fact, it wasn't really until the third episode, three episodes have gone out so far, sort of at the time we're talking, but it wasn't till the third episode that I started to, you know, actually feel a little bit of, you know, tingle of unease. The rest felt a bit silly to me.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. No, I wouldn't say silly. More just what the hell now? Like, because I managed my expectations. I wasn't really sure what to make of it going in, I mean, and I didn't do a lot of pre-reading because I wanted to just, you know, go in cold. And in the first episode, the monsters come late. So, you know, it's a quest story kind of that we get the group together. We get our carload together of who's in the car. There's Atticus Freeman, who is played by Jonathan Myers. So he is a Korean War veteran, and his quest is to find out what happened to his missing father. So that's kind of the premise of this show. And so he brings along his Uncle George, who's played by Courtney B. Vance, and his profession is, remember the movie Green Book, and the actual book, The Green Book, which is kind of a travelogue for African Americans making their way across the US, and this is the time of segregation. So, you know, it's an essential guide of where you can stay, where you're not welcome, etc. So he publishes a version of that. So they're joined by a woman, Letty, played by Jurnee Smollett, who, you know, she's quite politically active and, yeah, she goes along for the ride, and what a ride. But the first episode kind of just all sets this up, and it's the mystery of what's happened to his dad. You weave in the Lovecraft book elements, and there's references. The location of where his dad might be relates to some writings in a Lovecraft book. And then it's very late in the episode that they start to throw in some blood-sucking weird monster things.
these big CGI blobs.
Correct, yes. Which you take issue with. I was okay. Yeah, I was waiting for some horror element to come, so it sort of, we got that. But then I like the way actually it was just juxtaposed with the horrendously racist sheriff and police officers that they're around at the time. I found it really tense. There's a very slow moving police chase where the setup of the scene is they're in a sundowner town, which means that as a person of colour, it's best if you don't spend the night there, basically. You know, who knows what hell will be rained upon you. So sun setting, they're trying to make it past the city limits, and this sheriff who would love to have a go at them is in very slow pursuit. And the reason it's a slow chase is because of the speed limit. You know, when you're being pursued by a white nationalist sheriff, he'll do anything to try and detain you. You don't want to be breaking the speed limit. So, it's a 25-mile-an-hour hot pursuit. But, for such a slow scene, it was very tense.
I think the setup to that was done very well. The seriousness with which this black family take the sheriff's threat that you only have a certain amount of time before you have to cross county border or, you know, whatever it is. The threat really is that you will be lynched. And
of course, yeah.
And the way in which for the three black characters really is a reality that they're all too aware of.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what's real in every scene, really. There's another scene in the second episode where there's a diner and just it's all on display. And, you know, this is set in the 50s, but so much of it connects to the present day with just horrendous racism on display. And I love that it is a fantasy show, but for me, I just enjoy the drama of it. So, like, the silly, as you call them, like the horror elements, they just add to it. But, yeah, I'm finding it just a really riveting drama that's got a lot of meaning in, like, a support character has real-life connections back to history. Yeah, there's an array of articles about, you know, what certain scenes mean, who this represents. So it's multi-layered and, Yeah, I'm in.
The two young leads who I hadn't seen in anything before, but I do think they're very good. They do smolder on the screen. There's some nice chemistry between them. I've sort of found the tonal shifts. I'm not sure that I went with them every place that they were going. And episode three, after sort of having been this sort of quest narrative for the first two episodes, it suddenly turns into a fairly self-contained haunted house story, which did leave me sort of scratching my head and playing a bit of catch up. So I don't know how much I'm willing to take these kind of U-turns in the narrative before I sort of perhaps drift away.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm, because that first episode was so wild and I'm just sort of expecting U-turns all over the place, so that's kind of my default. I'm just ready for whatever
it's true. On the other hand, I'm kind of interested to see where it takes me.
Well, so there's 10 eps, so 7 more. Yeah, big yes for me.
I'm not sold that it hits the landing, but, you know, I'm intrigued enough to kind of follow where it might go.
Yeah.
So that's Lovecraft Country, and that's available on Foxtel and Binge.
And playing out weekly.
One thing this show did raise for me, so this is a show made by HBO, of which we're all very familiar. It forms the third series from HBO that I've watched this year that does delve into issues of race using a pre-existing property and in some ways tries to sort of reinvent that. And the other two that I'm thinking of are Perry Mason and Watchmen, which both aired earlier in the year. I mean, all these shows were produced really prior to the death of George Floyd and, you know, the kind of the recent, you know, heightened scrutiny around race in response to the Black Lives Matter protests. But they certainly all wear issues of race on their sleeve. And so I found that just very interesting. Of the three, Lovecraft Country is the only one from Black creators. The other two are from white creators. Watchmen comes from Damon Lindelof, who people sort of might know from his previous HBO series, The Leftovers, which was one of those shows which had a lot of critical adoration but didn't ever get that sort of audience critical mass. And then previously before that, Lost, which has both kind of fans and detractors, mainly detractors due to the way that the kind of narrative, the twisty narrative, ran out of steam. Although I do remember that reading that Michael Schur, who made The Good Place, Lost was one of his inspirations, and he did tap Damon Lindelof on the shoulder and ask for tips on sort of how to do these kind of twisty shows right.
Mm. Well, and Lindelof's made a big career out of script doctoring and like guest writing, I guess, to add up the twisties on a lot of scripts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Watchmen, because the original comic by Alan Moore is seen as, you know, such a defining moment in comic book graphic novel history. And, you know, it did a lot of new things that played with the form of comics, and it kind of used a superhero narrative to look at the issues of the Cold War and the threat of nuclear oblivion. And it did sort of very clever things about having narratives within narratives, playing sort of different timelines, using the format of the comic layout itself within the page to do different things with storytelling. And so in a way itself was seen as sort of pretty difficult to adapt. And I think Zack Snyder's adaptation is kind of seen as both, you know, pretty slavish to the book, but kind of, you know, not doing anything particularly interesting with the book.
We are no one. We are everyone. And we are invisible. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock.
We convinced ourselves that they were gone.
Tick,
but they were just hibernating.
Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock.
They came for everybody. Oh, please.
Are we safe? guess we have ourselves a reckoning.
What are you two talking about?
Oh, nothing. Just the end of the world.
What Damon Lindelof has done with his series, which sort of takes place as a bit of a sequel, is really invested with the issues of race, so that we do kick off in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with the Tulsa Massacre, which was a significant event in US history that for a long time was not taught in schools and, you know, had been erased from the history books, but where an incredibly successful, affluent African-American community were, you know, almost systematically wiped out by white locals who were armed. It was really an event which occurred in reality and which was an incredibly horrific event. And so from that, we see a small boy escape, his parents die, but we're not sure, you know, what has become of him. But out of that, we get a story of modern day Tulsa, Oklahoma, where due to police having been themselves the victim of white supremacist terrorist actions, the police have all been made to wear masks in order to hide their identity. And there's a question about the blurring of vigilante and police in that scenario. But visually, it's again kind of a bit of a confronting image because, you know, we're so used now to seeing masked figures in real life due to the pandemic. And in a way, visually, this kind of predicts that.
Yeah, right.
But I would say what starts out as a very intriguing kind of revealing look into the history of Black America. And Regina King plays the lead role as Angela Abar, a woman who is part of the Oklahoma police force, but sort of also has a sort of masked superhero style role. But to me, it did get lost along the way. And, you know, sort of ultimately the white supremacists who they're fighting against just become bad guys with bad plans that sort of get kind of sidelined in the spectacle of good versus evil.
Right.
So it sort of lost me in terms of the way that it dealt with those issues. The other show I was just going to mention, Perry Mason, again, created by a couple of white writers, and it's probably the most old-fashioned of the three series we've talked about, I think very deliberately so. It's a very sparse show, both in terms of writing and the look. And so much so, I almost did at times feel like I was watching a kind of black and white movie from the 1950s.
Yeah, right.
But, and of course, I mean, I don't know how much you know about the source material, Perry Mason.
You know, vague memory of an episode or two caught in rerun of Raymond Burr, but of the show anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it sort of was a series of successful novels and then became a hugely successful courtroom television drama, really sort of the first of its kind. One thing that fans of that show and that property might, you know, find a bit off-putting about this is really a kind of origin story of how Perry earned his stripes, so to speak.
Mr. Mason, certain matters require discretion and finesse. That's the kind of thing you're good at.
Wear your good suit.
This is my good suit.
You're a detective, Mr. Mason.
It's a fancy word for a busybody, but yes.
It's very easy for you to break the rules, isn't it? And you never accept any help.
How about I have a look? You stay in the truck.
Shut up.
Stop the car!
How can we help you, Mr. Baggerly?
Members of my church.
An unspeakable act has visited upon them.
The kidnapping gone way wrong. Worst thing you ever seen.
What do you know what I've seen?
We do what we don't like when there's a greater good to be served. You more than anyone should know that.
So he starts off in he's not even a lawyer yet. He's a private detective. And then through this one case, he gets drawn into eventually having to kind of take to the courtroom in order to fight for his defendant, the innocence of his defendant. But it works in, for what's such old-fashioned material, it works in these themes of race and sexuality and gender in a fairly ham-fisted way. I think that, you know, there's a bit of switched-up casting so that Perry Mason's sort of investigator, who was traditionally a white character, has been made into a black character. And there's a little, there are little nods to some of the discrimination that he experiences. And Perry Mason's assistant, his secretary, is sort of made a bit more of a proactive woman who also happens to be a gay woman as well. But I think for me, the issue with these representations was they're kind of done more as a box-ticking exercise than something that has any influence on the narrative or the storytelling itself.
Right. That is the risk, isn't it? Because like when you're setting something in the past when society's, you know, there's civil rights issues, not that we've solved any of that, but, you know, there's gender issues. How do you set something back then but still give a nod to the fact that you're not making it back then? Do you know what I mean? But I think a lot of shows do it really effectively. I'm not saying you can't do it, but, yeah, I think some shows do demonstrate the difficulty and maybe can show that maybe some better writing or, you know, just maybe who's in the writer's room as well can really make a difference there. So it's, yeah, some of them show the workings. I haven't seen Perry Mason, so I can't speak to that, but it sounds like that's what you're saying. They show the effort being made without showing the product at the end.
I mean, I think it's a very enjoyable series overall and you know, there's a lot of craft involved, but it's the kind of show that unironically will have a character say, oh, you'll make a great lady lawyer one day, and have the female character retort, I'll make a great lawyer one day, no qualifier. And and you can slightly imagine the white men in the writer's room all giving each other high fives at having thought of this retort.
Yeah, little winks like that. Yeah, I'm sure that's a real-life conversation that happened.
Yeah, you know, all said, I think all these series are worth watching, and it is interesting seeing this progression in the way that these issues have been handled from Perry Mason into, from Watchmen into Perry Mason into Lovecraft Country. And so all those series are available on Foxtel and Binge.
All right. Well, now we've come to the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching.
Yes. So, Fee, what have you been watching?
Thanks for asking, Ben. As everyone would know, we lost Chadwick Boseman on the weekend, which was a huge shock.
I don't think it was public at all, as far as I know, that he was, you know, undergoing any treatment or that he was unwell.
Yeah, no, I think intentionally, you know, it kept that secret. But, yeah, 4 years of living with colon cancer, stage 4, and, you know, 4 years, that's in the duration when he's become Chadwick Boseman, of course, through Black Panther, but, you know, such an incredible body of work, and all made while he was in the grips of this horrendous illness. But, you know, I guess it points to the fact that people live with illnesses and do amazing work. Like, it's not an unbelievable fact that he did this incredible output. And that it's not just filming something like Black Panther, which looked incredibly grueling, but it's also the press tour, all the press junkets, and all the demands on people while they're doing that. And it's in, I've been really loving all the tributes and videos that get shared of just the moments of people, you know, speaking to what it meant to have a black superhero in a Marvel movie, lead a Marvel movie, have a mainstream blockbuster depict an Africa, you know, untouched by colonialism, where it was thriving in Wakanda. And, as is my wont, I always like to watch a movie. You know, we've discussed this before, when someone passes away. I'm not rowing that boat alone. I think a lot of people do that. We saw Black Panther and Marshall, and this film I'm about to speak about, Girl Gone Up, they've all been hitting the charts in on iTunes, I think, and Defied Bloods, which we talked about as well, is doing really well on Netflix as well. Yeah, because when we lose someone, you like to memorialise them through their work. So, one I caught on the weekend in the lead up to its debut on SBS Viceland next week is Get On Up, the James Brown biopic, in which he plays, of course, James Brown.
Doesn't work musically.
Doesn't sound good. Get up. Doesn't feel good. Get up. If it sound good and it feel good, then it's musical.
He's incredible in it. And, you know, he becomes James Brown. The dancing is in particular. He's got the footwork down.
And those are some moves. James Brown's moves. That's not easy to do.
It is not. No, the slides, the, look, I can't even put it into words. It's so good.
I mean, as I recall, although I understand this was a bit of showmanship, James Brown would routinely get injured pulling those moves off.
Yeah, and someone would have to help him off the stage. But he'd be back in business the next show. Yes, indeed, and there's a little bit of that in here as well. So, you know, it is a biopic, so take that with a grain of salt. It follows some of the tropes of biopics in that it does try to encompass an entire life, a very complicated life. And, you know, the trend lately in some biopics has been to take a segment of a life to represent the bigger picture story because it can be, you know, as a way to try and get around some of these tropes of biopics.
Whereas, which can be a sort of more successful strategy sometimes.
Yes. Personally, that's my preference of a biopic. But, but Get On Up does, it jumps timelines a lot. So it's certainly not cradle to grave kind of story, the chronology, but it does cover cradle to grave or kind of kindergarten to grave in all the terrain covered in James Brown's life. So, you know, very troubled childhood, a lot of violence in that household, which then he replicated in his own households as an adult, which is all covered. But it starts off in a really strange spot. Late career James taking a woman to task for using the bathroom in one of the businesses that he owned, that he franchised, I guess. In a bit of a moment of the crazy that is associated with him and shoots the ceiling, et cetera. Then we come back to that moment a bit later. So we start with, well, this is not just going to be about the music. Mm. But there's a whole lot of music in it too. And incredible, like it's cut really well to the music, I think, as well. You know, the title song, of course, but I'm Black and I'm Proud. There's a great, it's just a moment, but in a recording studio with a bunch of kids and his wife. The performance is what stands out, of course, in this. And, there's a nice remembrance that the director, Tate Taylor, has written. There's been a lot of eulogising, as happens. There's a nice one. But on set, he went method. he was James Brown on the set and, you know, even being playfully pervy with one of the first ADs. But I think, you know, she didn't mind. So it was not a Me Too moment. It was more him getting into character with her permission. So just in a bit of cheeky banter, I hasten to add. But, he was doing the strut around the set and staying in character the whole time, which is an interesting way to infuse your viewing of Get On Up when you watch it on Viceland on the 9th of September.
It's
fun.
Chadwick Boseman seemed to have made a little bit of in a relatively short career, a bit of a speciality in playing real life roles. Thurwood Marshall, the Supreme Court judge you mentioned, and also Jackie Robinson, the baseball player.
Absolutely.
In 42. All these 42. Sort of incredibly significant black historical figures.
Yep. Absolutely right. So, yeah, and, you know, what a legacy to leave these kind of only a handful of films, but to have had such an impact. And then, of course, with Black Panther, so, you know, every kid, a lot of kids have seen and admire that role. But, it does call into question how does that franchise continue, but I guess I'll sort that out. There's a wonderful piece written by Ryan Coogler, his director, the director of Black Panther, remembering him on set and their collaboration. So,
Very great. Sad news. And let's face it, one of the pleasures of a biopic is just seeing that aging makeup slathered on an actor's face. So, you know, if they all were just to look at one period in a person's life, we wouldn't get that full joy.
That is true.
So that's another gift that Chadwick Boseman has left us.
Quite right. And, I mean, the wigs and the outfits in this alone, it's a real visual treat. So you can watch Get On Up on Wednesday the 9th of September at 8:30pm on SBS Viceland. It's also coming to NITV and you can catch it at SBS On Demand from the 9th. So, Ben, what have you been watching?
Well, I came across a new show on Netflix called Unwell. So one thing that I think that Netflix is getting quite good at is sort of that using their carousel and, you know, their kind of landing page to kind of serve you shows that I guess, you know, sort of may or may not have been influenced by your past viewing choices, but where you're kind of in that realm of I don't really know what I feel like watching, but I'll give this a go. So this was one of my give it a go options, and I was quite impressed. I think that so this is it's a documentary series. I think it's 6 episodes. I think it's intended as a returning show. One area that Netflix has been criticized for in the past is kind of just, you know, throwing up some feature docs in the sort of health wellness space that maybe make some, you know, wild claims, you know, maybe some factually inaccurate claims or at least contested claims. And I guess sort of you could say that this show is intended as a bit of a correction for that. So each episode focuses on a different type of alternative therapy. So we've got essential oils, tantric sex, adults drinking human breast milk, fasting, which, you know, I've participated in the past, full disclosure, beasting therapy. So there's sort of...
sorry, what?
Beasting therapy.
Oh, beasting.
Yes.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
I don't know. With that list, who knows?
That episode I haven't got to yet. That's the final episode. So I've got that still to enjoy. And enjoy it I will, I think, based on the four that I've seen. Because I think sort of what it does, and it does it in a sort of relatively even-handed way, is you get some crazies. And you get some people who embrace these therapies that seem, you know, in a quite sort of rational, reasonable, in moderation way. And you get some, you know, scientific professionals who, you know, offer a bit of a sort of counterpoint to those who take up these you know, different practices. And often episodes sort of take you on a tangent that you weren't quite expecting. So the essential oils episode actually quite quickly becomes an episode about multi-level marketing and pyramid schemes, because that's how these products are largely sold in the US. And even there's sort of this deep dive into this wild Midwestern, you know, almost like cult-like figure who was running one of these multi-level marketing schemes, and just sort of how ineffective they are and how so many people lose money participating in them. But they get hooked in because they think that they're doing something that's going to sort of benefit themselves and their neighbors and friends.
Yeah.
And it looks at different issues about sort of people who actually put essential oils, they consume them orally, which comes with a whole bunch of risks, you know, opposed to just doing a few, you know, kind of scented fragrances here and there. The tantric sex episode sort of delves into cultural appropriation and how, you know, people have kind of profited on this idea of Eastern mysticism, which is actually completely devoid of any knowledge of the religious practices on which it was originally based. The breast milk episode takes us on a whole tangent about milk banks and how they're necessary in order to help premature babies who are unable to feed from their mother's breast naturally, but how the donation of human milk allows them, you know, to sort of have access to all that nutritional benefit that human breast milk provides. But then, you know, bodybuilders are now using it as a way to bulk up, and there's a kind of big black market kind of, you know, whole industry out there. So, you know, I was sort of sold hook, line and sinker on on this show. And I do think it's an interesting model that Netflix are pursuing. I feel like they've sort of moved away. If they ever really were in the kind of business of, you know, the big high budget buzzy drama, I mean, I think sort of Stranger Things is probably the closest that they ever sort of came to that. But I think they've much more quickly started to focus their business on niche audiences, which includes certainly documentary audiences, for whom I think in the US audiences are severely underserved with factual content, because certainly, you know, none of the big TV networks, commercial TV networks in the US are sort of really touching it, you know. Yeah, I think sort of it's something to look out for. It's unwell, and I feel like it is intended as a returning series, but the first season is now out on Netflix now.
Okay, yeah. Well, I will actually check it out now that you've explained all that, yeah. Come for the breast milk, stay for the deep story. Please don't use that at the start of the episode, Jess.
And I did, because I have done various forms of intermittent fasting, I did sort of suddenly in that episode, after having poo-pooed all the people who were taking up these alternative therapies, sort of start to kind of feel like, no, like this is justified. There's a lot of studies that have shown the benefits of this. And to be honest, it did make me realize, you know, how easy it is to fall into the pattern, rightly or wrongly, sort of where you make use of these alternative therapies.
Sounds good.
Sophie, you gave us a pick for OD for SBS On Demand, which was Get On Up.
Yeah.
The James Brown flick.
Yes, I did. So I don't think I need to give another one this week. Have you got one?
Well, I thought I would just give a quick shout out to Sydney Super Tunnel, which is a four-part Australian series which has been running on SBS and soon will have all episodes available on SBS On Demand. Fee, are you a fan of tunnels?
Oh, look, I had a dollar for every time someone asked me that question, Ben. look, I mean,
particularly trains going into tunnels.
Look, I've travelled in some, not for several months, it must be said. I can't remember the last time I got on a train. But, yeah, look, you know, in and of themselves, they do fascinate me in terms of how they get constructed. But I must confess, I've not watched Sydney Super Tunnel. sell it to me.
Well, I'm sure we can all agree that of the benefits of public transport...
Of a
viable public transportation system, and I think I do think, you know, there's kind of parallels. This series focuses particularly on the building of the Sydney Metro, but there are sort of similar transportation systems all around the world and in other parts of the country. Certainly, I think there's sort of a move back towards light rail that's been a fairly recent trend.
Certainly in Sydney, yes.
Yeah. Well, and in Canberra, my hometown as well. And Melbourne, of course, never, ever turned its back on the tram. But the metro is sort of different in that, well, in Sydney we have these sort of traditionally these double-decker trains which do take some considerable time to board on and off. And a metro system people would be kind of familiar with, you know, perhaps like the London Tube or the subway in New York, or the metro itself in Paris, and where the intention is that you have a lot faster movement on and off. So it's really about getting commuters from sort of A to B and into the big, you know, CBD areas quickly. And so I can tell you're fascinated.
No, I'm hanging on your every word.
But
tell me more about public transportation.
But the Sydney Metro has required a pretty massive engineering project, and there are many people out there that don't mind a television show that focuses on a massive engineering project, and this does include one big building of a new tunnel underneath Sydney Harbour in order to transport people around this very overcrowded city of ours with very poor traffic options. So all I can say is people have been enjoying it. If it sounds like something that you might get something out of, take a look. It's on SBS On Demand.
Absolutely. Story of the city through its tunnel. I'm not.
I can't wait to click my Opal card and whiz through.
Tap on to that one.
People might be listening to all kinds of podcasts while they're on public transport.
It's true. They're probably all listening to the playlist.
Be nice to think.
Yeah.
Well, I think that just brings us to the end of our show for another week.
Where do you go after that? Of course, yeah, we have to wrap this up. We're pulling into the station. I'll stop. I'll let you finish.
Yes, certainly. And make sure you subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcast, so you too can enjoy it on your daily commute. And give us a lot of stars and leave a nice review, because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot. Until next week.
Thanks for listening.